Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 11:07 British Summer Time. Today is October 3rd. And of course, it being Saturday, I'm a day late in recording the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But I just didn't think I'd be able to give it my best if I were to start recording after midnight last night. So what we've seen over the last week is a growing questioning by investors as to just how much further the persistent and consistent advances that have been going for the last 6 months, how much further they can go. Stock markets have been buoyed over the last 6 months, initially by the short covering rally, and that gave way to a rather surprising earnings season, which helped to boost stocks even further. Then we had central bankers and politicians all over the world reiterating that they weren't going to remove their stimulus anytime soon, and that was a further support to stock markets. And most recently, we've had some rather significant M&A activity, which has also helped to put a premium on certain stocks. And one has to ask, what is the next piece of good news that will help to support stock markets? Because we finished a remarkable third quarter and we're into the fourth quarter now. And are earnings going to be as good in the fourth quarter as they were in the first, second, and or in the third quarter particularly? And are we going to see another stimulus package? Certainly, monetary conditions remain extremely accommodative, and there is the strong likelihood that stimulus isn't going to be removed in the fourth quarter. But I think there is a question as to just how much more stimulus is going to be put in during the fourth quarter. And M&A activity has certainly helped to support markets over the last couple of weeks, but if we look over the next few months, if we are moving into a more risky type environment for stock markets, would potential acquirers be better advised to wait it out a little bit so that they have a better chance of picking up their target at a better price? Because while I think we could have said with a high degree of objectivity back in March that stocks were relatively cheap, that is no longer the case. Depending on how one measures these things, you could say that markets are at the S&P, for example, is at something approaching fair value, but there are some of the better performing emerging markets which have probably gone through fair value and are pricing in a really a best case scenario at current levels. And this does suggest that given the relative overextension compared to the moving averages, or the 200-day moving average, that we are probably closer to a reversionary type environment, which would see markets either follow a China type template and pull back sharply towards the moving average and range around that area in a support building phase, or they can move into a gradual range and consolidation, which allows underlying trading to catch up with where markets have been able to move over the last few months. And it remains very much an open question. The prime consistency characteristic over the last 6 months has been the progression of higher reaction lows, and they remain intact. Now, we've had some aggressive selling in some stock markets from the middle of this week, and a number found support in here today, which suggests that it's probably not going to be all one-way action if we do move into a reactionary type environment. And we have to bear in mind that while we are climbing a wall of worry, and there is still a relatively easy bearish case to make about the global economy, that with the monetary stimulus and the way that the various financials have been bailed out by the yield curve, we are in an extraordinarily accommodative situation. And while stock markets have probably run ahead a little bit too quickly, in the short term. The strong likelihood remains that we are in a new bull market type environment, and that any kind of reactionary type environment which sees reversions towards the mean is likely to be a buying opportunity for the medium to longer term in better performing assets. We had an interesting email during the week asking about why some markets hadn't had the big Type 3 base following the crash that we saw last year. And the Nasdaq is a very good example, because back in 2000, when the TMT bubble burst and we saw technology shares all over the world collapsing, and the Neue Macht in Germany actually disappearing, we saw that technology has taken a very long time to recover. Now, it's a leading stock market sector, and it will often perform best when interest rates are low and the availability of credit and liquidity is funneled into these potentially high growth areas. But when you look at the Nasdaq over the last 10 years, it hasn't done very much of anything following the crash. And that is a potential template for what a number of the bank shares could do. We continue to see that a large number of smaller regional banks remain in trouble in the USA, that the number of those types of banks is likely to decrease quite considerably over the coming decade. There's going to be severe rationalization. And just like in the technology sector, there are going to be banks which can completely avoid this base building phase which unwinds the excesses of the previous bubble. And clearly, in the technology market, you would have to put Apple and Google in that elite club of shares that completely avoided the meltdown in the technology sector. But in the banking sector, there are also these shares that are going to avoid the big unwinding of risk and the massive impairment of their balance sheets. And a quick perusal of the various sectors in the S&P that hold banks will give you a very clear idea of which banks are performing and which aren't. Because those that have failed to perform over the last 6 months, there really must be a problem. Because if a bank can't make money when the yield curve is so steep, where they can basically get money for nothing from the Fed and invest it in performing markets, or even just invest it on the long end of the curve and pick up 200 or 300 basis points, if they're not making money on their trading books in this type of environment, then there really is some serious problems. And on the other hand, if you have banks that are currently testing their all-time highs following a very good performance over the last year, one would have to give the benefit of the doubt that it is going to be those banks are going to be leading the financial sector out of this recession, that they're going to be the leading banks, leading financials in the coming bull market. And we should, of course, be aware that no bull market unfolds without the participation in one shape or form of the financial sector. Are we going to have the level of securitization or the lax regulation that contributed to the credit crisis? Probably not. But we continue to see that the companies right across the world that are doing best, that are particularly performing best in the USA and in Europe, are those that have a sound global franchise, solid balance sheets, and that have a sound cash flow. Now, even leading banks probably don't fit into those categories, but we also know from the stress tests which banks have been designated as being too big to fail. And They are largely the ones, or certainly the better performing banks are on that list. So even though they still have these big problems with their balance sheets, they're not going to be allowed to go bust. And that probably does allow them to capitalize on their global franchise because the number of big banks has suddenly got a lot smaller. And while we are going to see that some of the participants in the worst performing sector over the last year are going to perform considerably better than their peers, they are still going to have trouble competing with some of the banks that were able to avoid the credit crisis entirely. And for example, when you look at a country like India, where the banks are pushing on aggressively to new high ground, or new recovery highs, and leading that market higher, one can't but compare the two sectors and look at India and a number of other emerging markets and say, well, the biggest problem they've got is expanding their network of branches fast enough to get as much of the business from these new consumers and growing economies that they possibly can. They don't have this heavy reliance on fancy securitization or derivatives because they don't have any need of it. And that is where we're going to see growth in the banking sector globally. It's going to be in the emerging markets, which currently have a strong position in terms of how healthy their balance sheets are. And there was also, I think it was in Tim Price's report this week, where he cited a map from The Economist showing the relative indebtedness of each country. And obviously, the Western world is the most indebted. And you can look at that in a number of different ways. You can look at it on the one hand and say, well, the USA and Europe have got a remarkable amount of debt, and they're going to have trouble paying that off, or they're going to have to do things like raise interest rates, or sorry, not raise interest rates, raise taxes, and they're going to have to cut spending. And then we look at the emerging world, which is, as a percentage of capital or per capita basis, is less indebted, which on the one hand says that they have sounder economies, but on the other hand says that they've got plenty of room to take on more debt. And there is a strong likelihood that that is probably what they're going to do over the coming years, where the conditions of trade for these countries is going to get considerably better, as they can, a number of them are surplus countries, and they will have the ability to borrow in the international markets at lower rates going forward than they had ever imagined less than 10 or 15 years ago. When we look at the performance of emerging market currencies, they took a big hit during the currency crisis, but they are recovering really quite firmly. And while the dollar particularly has been in a downtrend for much of the last 6 months, and again, people are starting to ask just how much lower the dollar is going to go, and we're already seeing, well, there's a headline on the Bloomberg in front of me saying G7 finance officials push for strong dollar before meeting in Istanbul. Now, we can, it's on the one hand, you have the Treasury and the Fed talking about the how good it is to have a strong dollar, but when the US trading partners start asking for a stronger dollar, then it is probably wise to become a little bit more cautious. We've had a very consistent 6 month decline in the dollar, which obviously translates into a 6 month advance for every other currency compared to the dollar. And we've already seen that New Zealand and Switzerland and the ECB have complained about the weakness of the dollar and the relative strength of their own currencies. And that would suggest that they are unwilling to see the dollar fall very much further. Now, they may not have much choice in the matter because there is only so much talking the dollar up will do. But if central bankers decide to put their money where their mouths are, then we could easily have a stronger dollar rally. This would likely coincide with a larger reaction in the stock markets and would obviously be a headwind for commodity markets. Yesterday, when we were driving home from Dublin, they announced which city was awarded the Olympics, and there were four contenders. And I thought we were Mrs. Tracy and I were chatting about it before they made the announcement. And the four countries that were seeking to host the Olympics were the USA in Chicago, Spain in Madrid, Japan in Tokyo, and Brazil in Rio. And well, when you look at those four countries, the USA was where the credit crisis started, and Spain had one of the biggest housing bubbles in the world, and certainly in Europe, and Japan has one of the largest net debts in the world, and remains in a moribund condition. And of the four countries, if you leave any other condition aside, Brazil is the one that's probably going to have the cash to pay for the Olympics in 2016. It's probably going to have one of the stronger economies of the four in terms of its growth rate in 2016. And it's probably a signal of where we're seeing the growth in the world, where we're seeing increased confidence in the ability of these countries to actually make good on their potential. The days when Charles de Gaulle was able to say that Brazil has enormous potential and always will are long gone. Brazil is on the ascendancy, fueled by its commodities, and it is a strong exporter of just about every commodity, but also by its sound economic policies and fiscal responsibility, which have been very much a feature of the market for the last decade. And it is encouraging that they are making sounds as if they realize where they've made mistakes in the past and what they've done right in the last decade and are looking to continue on that path. With the remarkable amount of stimulus that is being added into the global economy, we have to ask two important questions. One is when central banks are going to begin removing it, and how successful they're going to be in doing that. Because we have, on the one hand, huge amounts of liquidity in the market, and quantitative easing, which is the dilution of the currency base, is tantamount to stealth inflation, provided we are assuming that central banks aren't particularly good at sanitizing the liquidity once they've put it out there. The other big question is, where is all of this excess liquidity being invested? And looking around the world, we can see that the best performing markets have been in emerging Asia and commodity producing Latin America, and to an extent in the commodity markets. Certainly over the last 3 months in particular, we've seen some of the lagging markets playing catch up, and some of those Eastern European and Middle Eastern markets have broken upwards from their bases. But in terms of absolute performance, and in terms of the timing of their performance, it's definitely been in the Asian region and commodity-producing Latin America, which have produced the fastest, and the best performances over the last year. And that in itself is noteworthy because it gives us an indication of where investors are beginning to look for longer term returns. Because it's going to take a significant period of time for the economies that were most affected by the credit bubble to rehabilitate. And there will certainly be individual shares and individual sectors that are focused on those domestic economies will perform, but the sectors and companies that have a global franchise will probably perform better and as a sector on a more consistent basis. And the emerging economies that are building their own global franchises, that are moving up the value chain, that are investing heavily in infrastructure for their young populations, and are aggressively building out their infrastructure, both in terms of how people, of what they need for people to live in a in relative comfort, but also in terms of their industrial output. And this last decade and coming decades has seen a major change because now we have an additional 3 billion consumers that want all of the things for their lives that in the West we take for granted. And they're on the way to getting it. If we look for probably one of the first things that people buy when they want to be seen as participating in the modern economy and have enough cash that they are new consumers is a mobile phone. And mobile phone usage continues to surge across the emerging world, not only in Asia and Latin America, but also in Africa. That's probably the first step. And probably the next step is getting a motorcycle or scooter, or moving into a house that has indoor plumbing, or getting electricity and TVs and fridges. And all of these are major steps in the consumer economy. And we can anticipate that not only will the percentage or the per capita consumption of industrial commodities rise across the emerging world, but that diets are also likely to improve, and that will cause a greater demand for food, which is the major bull support for the commodity bull market, that we have rising demand on a secular basis, and we have inelastic supply. During the credit crisis, we saw that funding for hundreds, if not thousands, of different projects disappeared. On the one hand, because the high commodity prices that were used to justify the business plans were no longer evident, but on the other, the banks simply didn't have the cash to lend. And that has pulled us back into a situation which is not unlike what we saw back in 2003. We saw that demand was beginning to push upwards, and we are likely now coming out of the global recession. And whereas growth may be slower on a sustained basis in the West, it's likely to get back to pre-crisis levels in emerging markets, and we're probably going to enter a period of synchronized global economic expansion. It might not be as fast as that which prevailed before 2007, but if the global economy is expanding and the focus of that expansion is where the big population centers are, then the per capita demand for commodities is probably going to increase. But supply is going to have a hard time keeping pace because the money just isn't there to build the infrastructure that's needed to increase supply today so that it will be ready when demand really does meet the road. And that suggests that the kind of environment we're in today is quite similar to that back in 2003, and that suggests that commodity-related investments could well outperform over the medium to longer term. Inflation is something that a lot of people have worried about because inflation, on the one hand, it almost certainly coincides with commodity outperformance. And central bankers have been very accommodative in making large piles of cash available that they probably didn't have in the first place. So we're running serious risks that central banks are going to mess up and they're not going to take this liquidity out of the system when the velocity of money begins to pick up again. And we could easily be sitting on an inflationary time bomb. That's not a problem today. It could be a problem in the medium to longer term. Excuse me. In the medium to longer term. And above all else, it's something that really does bear watching because inflationary pressures are not likely to appear in wages or in house prices, but they are most likely to appear first in commodity prices. And if we were to start seeing oil in particular, but industrial or food commodities pushing upwards to test the highs that we saw last year, and some of them are not that far off, although oil still remains at less than half its peak value, then we will start to see people worrying about inflation or stagflation. If we see a larger reaction to unfolding, which is probably going to be a buying opportunity over the medium term, but in the short term, we're probably going to see that the deflationary argument is trotted out once more. And that got a bit of a boost in the last week because treasuries broke upwards from a 4-month range, suggesting that at least some investors are taking some money off the table and putting it into inverted commas safe haven type assets. And that, on the one hand, helps to explain the strength in treasury bonds and the declining yield there, and also the relative firmness of the dollar over the last week in particular. So even though people are hedging or appear to be hedging their long exposure to stock markets or commodities, it's still very difficult to make a bullish case for the US Treasury market, apart from suggesting that people will go there when we have a reversionary type environment. Because when that reversion has completed, then the chances are that these government bonds are going to be a short, with the incredible amount of supply in that market and the paltry yields that are on offer for really quite long-dated investments, then one really does have to ask the question, if they want our money so badly, do we really want to lend it to them at such remarkably low yields for such a long time? And I think that is an increasingly important question. Now, the chances are that the 10-year yield probably bottomed down there at 2%, and it's probably going to take a significant period of time before we see yields push upwards and break upwards from the developing base formation. But the deflationary fears that were evident a year ago are unlikely to be repeated because the massive unwinding of leverage that the panic in October coincided with, we don't have the leverage in the market today that we did a year ago, in which case it's impossible to repeat to the same extent. That doesn't mean that we can't have sharp reactions within the overall bull market, but provided monetary conditions remain accommodative, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside to risk type assets in stock markets and commodities over the medium to longer term, and the chances are that emerging markets in Asia and Latin America and the commodity sector are likely to outperform on a long-term basis. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.